and your mama would tell you, if you play with fire, you'll get burned. Well, rapper Joey Badass didn't get the memo and learned the hard way after reports say he allegedly stared at the sun during the solar eclipse earlier this week.
It's business time, baby.
The Sala Monster sounds off.
My client!
Mama Monster!
Conquered the street!
This doesn't make any sense.
Your title belt is made of leather. You're not a real vegan.
He's fat, delete!
You haven't been beat up properly! Woo!
This is episode 510 of the Sala Monster Sounds Off. Here for Sunday, August 27th, 2017. I am the Sala Monster. You like that, huh? Lapsing into my Vince McMahon impression? Sala Monster sounds off. Damn it. Well, it is August 27th. I am the Sala Monster. As I said, I want to send well wishes out first and foremost to those in Texas who got hit by Hurricane Harvey. Hurricane Sandy here in New York was no fun all those years ago, so hopefully everybody listening to this podcast anyway is doing okay and is not without power. I know a lot of people had their power knocked out, and we got a lot to talk about here. We're going to talk a little bit about Mayweather-McGregor here in a second, and I got some thoughts on Jon Jones and a lot of other post-SummerSlam stuff. A lot of stuff to get to. We are going to do a mailbag this week. It is rare that we do not do one. We didn't do one last week, but I promise you we will dive into a bunch of questions here at the end of the podcast this week. Thank you to the great folks at Audible. They continue to be a fine sponsor here of this podcast and give us the chance, give me the chance, to provide you guys with a free trial of their service, free for 30 days, and one free audiobook that, as you well know, you get to keep no matter what. You guys have heard this. If you have not yet cashed in, take advantage. Use our link, audibletrial.com/Sala Monster. There is a lot of great wrestling books up there. People have asked me for recommendations, and I can't say enough good things about it. Really, any of Chris Jericho's books. I think only the second one of his is up there. That's a great book, as is the Daniel Bryan book I've heard. I still haven't really gotten to it. The Bob Holly book, tremendous. And just a ton of different ones up there. So whether it's a wrestling book or not, get one free book. Even if you cancel before the 30-day trial is up, it belongs to you. You can keep it and do whatever you want with it. Make sweet love to it. I got a little perverted there. I apologize. But audibletrial.com/Sala Monster is the link to use. You have to sign up or else it doesn't mean anything just to go to the link. So sign up, start the trial, get yourself a free book. Also, the Mama Monster, the first Mama Monster shirt is up in two different colors, white shirt and in a light blue color. And those of you who saw me wearing the Mama Monster shirt at our meetup here in Brooklyn last weekend, I was wearing the light blue color. I'm a blue guy, so that's my preference, in the soft cotton, if I had a recommendation. But please go ahead and check out all of the shirts. We have 30 of them up in our store, including the Solo Mountie shirt and all the classic shirts, Sound Off Guy and whatnot. They're all up there on prowrestlingtees.com/Sala Monster Sounds Off. And there's another brand new one actually popping up there in another week or two. So bookmark that and keep an eye out for that one. And also, of course, I'd be remiss if I didn't mention all of the PayPal support that we get each and every week. Can't say enough good things about all of our donators, $10 or more. We'll get you a wrestling nickname and a shout out here on the show. Thank you, as always, to John Loose Cannon Lopez, Deadpool James Herrera, I was going to say Breast Mode. Hey, why not? Breast Mode Brock Joseph. Thank you. The Florida Freebird Bryant Becerra. I think we all kind of go into breast mode every single week. Some of us, anyway. Out of Control Cody Thomas, Raymond the Mountie Medina, Massgrave Micah Harshaw, Velvet Revolver Robert Murray, Aim for the Head Andrew Jorlog, the Brooklyn Bombers, Jamel and Isaiah Walker, the Asian Sensation, Justin Lowe, Davis the Empire Enos, Brian the Cleaver Carpenter, the Show-Off Corey Van Dam, the Chicago Slayer, Willie Eichard, Kind of a Big Deal, Corey Blake, Stephen Handyman Halistic, the Main Attraction, Jackson Scott, the DC Slayer Marcus Cross, the Malaysian Mastermind Samuel T, and Sven Too Crazy Pellman, Superbad Soraya Allen. You can tune in to the Over the Top Rope podcast live every Wednesday at 8 p.m. on YouTube. Click the subscribe button to surrender and become a member. Also, Tyler the Boss Williams. I got to meet Tyler for the first time at our meetup last weekend. He and his cousin Darren, who actually won our Wrestle Crate raffle. So congrats to him. Tyler has a YouTube channel. He's got a ton of wrestling videos up there, gaming videos. He does WWE 2K17 live streams. He'll obviously be doing a lot of 2K18 content very soon once that game is out. You can check him out at youtube.com/TylerWilliams. And that's the easiest way to get to his channel. So again, thank you to Tyler. Also, happy birthday to Kevin Freeze. And well wishes for a speedy recovery from bypass surgery. Alicia got me up to speed on what happened. That is terrible. But again, all the best in your recovery. Here's hoping you get back to 100% real soon. And in the meantime, the Sound Off will be here for you to listen to every week as you convalesce. And so again, thank you to everybody who contributed this week. The support that you show with these donations really means a lot to me. People rave, for example, about the microphone that I was using in my videos when I did all those 2K18 launch party videos last week. Yeah, I'm able to buy stuff like that to use for this show, in part because of the support that you guys show me. So again, thank you very much. I saw the fight last night between Mayweather and McGregor, and it was funny, you know, both guys were smiling at different points in the fight. Hey, I'd smile too if I was walking away with a $100 million payoff if I'm Conor, or what is it, I think for Mayweather, like $300 million or something. If I made a quarter of that in one night, I'd have a nice big fat smile on my face. In fact, I'd step into the ring and let Mayweather knock me out for that kind of money. So a lot of people got very rich last night. I will say that Conor, you know, I thought this was going to be a quick fight. He went 10 rounds. He almost went the distance. And by about the ninth round, I'm watching this saying, man, this guy is gassed. He is gassed. And somehow he made it to the 10th round. And in round 10, I even said before they went back out there, I'm like, this guy's done. He's got spaghetti legs. He's barely able to stand up. I was just wondering how long the referee was going to let it go on for. The guy wasn't even throwing any punches anymore. And finally, the referee steps in and stops it. Look, respect to him, man. I mean, he tried something that he had never done before. He went in there with a world-class athlete. You know, I know Floyd is, 40 years old now. He hasn't fought in a while. But still, you know, he's regarded as the best in the world at his craft. And it takes a lot of balls to step in there and get punched in the face by somebody who's been doing this for, you know, however many years it's been, 49 fights, the guy's undefeated, now he's 50-0. So respect to Conor McGregor, but it was very obvious there at the end that he was done. And he was going down. The referee saved him from a knockout because that's where that fight was headed. And I love how in the post-fight interview, Conor was like, man, I wish the referee would have just let it go on. Let him knock me down. Let him put me down. He's like, I get tired. I get fatigued. That's what happens. The referee should have just let Floyd put me down. That defeats the whole purpose of having a referee in there in the first place. The referee can see what's going on. It's his job to step in there. And that's what he did. The guy did his job. You know, part of me did really want to see Mayweather get his ass knocked. I don't like Floyd Mayweather at all. How people can just kind of brush his background and his history under the rug like that. I mean, I think it was when I read, what was it, the testimony, I think, of his son, who was like 10 years old at the time, who gave a very vivid description of Floyd, like beating the crap out of his mother. And, you know, Floyd seems to think, well, you know, there's no photos, there's no evidence of any of this, so therefore you can't accuse me of this, that, and the other. You know, the guy's still a piece of garbage, and it would have warmed my heart to see him get knocked on his ass. But he is a very good fighter. No one can deny that. And, you know, we'll see people talking about a rematch and all this. I think the guy is done. I think 50-0, it's a nice, big, fat, round number. And he's got more money than God right now. So there's really no reason for him to fight. I think when he says he's done, I do think he's done. And Conor now gets to go back to UFC and make Dana White's life a living hell. by commanding even more money when he fights in the future. One more fight note, although this does tie in sort of to wrestling, I guess. The Dumbest Man in America award for this week goes to the very likely soon-to-be former UFC light heavyweight champion John Jones. TMZ broke the news that Jones tested positive for the anabolic steroid turinabol before his last fight with Daniel Cormier. Don't you just hate when that happens? You go to GNC, you want to buy your protein powder and some supplements, and damn it, somebody slips in some turinabol. Hate when that happens. Happens to all of us. That fight with Cormier was his first coming off a one-year ban for his first suspension under USADA rules. Actually, he was suspended, as some of you pointed out, once before for cocaine. I guess that didn't fall under these rules, or maybe it was out of competition, whatever the case was. But if this holds up, if they test, because again, you know, he's entitled to due process. Even Cormier came out, and Cormier is no fan of John Jones. But he came out and said the guy is entitled to due process and he'll appeal and all that. But if they test the B sample and that also comes back dirty and basically just confirms what we kind of already know, and if his camp appeals, let's say, and they fail, he could be banned for up to 4 years. And I say good. If he is guilty, I hope he is. If they retest that and that comes back dirty, they should boot his ass out for the full 4 years. Before his last fight with Cormier, talk about the gall of this guy. Before that last fight with Cormier, people found an old tweet. He tweeted this out. He said, "Daniel says the only reason I beat him the first time is because I must have been on steroids. Wonder what his excuse will be this time." Talk about tweets that don't age well. This guy is a complete and total fraud. I watched that post-fight performance he put on after that Cormier fight where he cried and he thanked everybody for standing by him, even after all the drug stuff, even after hitting a pregnant woman in that hit and run where he grabbed, what was it? He was in the hit and run and then he ran back to the car and reached in to grab a bunch of cash and then jumped over a wall or something. You know, after all that stuff, oh, what a great comeback story. But I said it after that fight. When I saw that performance after the fight, I said, this guy deserves an Academy Award for that performance. He's a better actor than most people in WWE. He should quit fighting and just go to Hollywood. He could do all the drugs he wants there and get paid for it. You know, there are people who say he may be the greatest fighter of all time. You know, people used to say the same thing in baseball about Barry Bonds. They used to say the same thing in cycling about Lance Armstrong. What are they up to these days? You don't hear too much about those guys now, do you? That'll end up being John Jones. All because he's too stupid to get out of his own way. Brock Lesnar can't be too happy about all this. If John Jones does get banned, maybe it's not 4 years. Maybe he gets banned for 2 years. Whatever it is, if that happens, there goes that big fight next year. And whatever leverage Lesnar may have been hoping for in negotiating with WWE, his contract is up with next year's WrestleMania. He hasn't re-signed. Randy Orton even razzed him not too long ago on Twitter. About a month ago, he quoted someone's tweet that said, "Get the new Brock Lesnar, eat, sleep, threaten to leave for UFC when your contract is up to get more money, repeat shirt." And Orton thought that was hilarious. That's what Brock does. His contract comes up, all of a sudden he gets the itch. He wants to fight again. He gets the itch to go back to UFC. It's amazing how that works. And now his big money fight has potentially been taken away from him. And now I see people, you know, pitching a John Jones-Brock Lesnar match in WWE. Sure, why not? Let's reward the guy. Let's reward him. Let's reward a guy who failed a test for steroids by bringing him into WWE, a company that has its own drug testing policy for steroids. Granted, he wouldn't be subject to it, but still. And let's pay him for one fight, for one match, I should say, multiples of what most of the guys in that company, if not all the guys in that company, probably make in a year. You know, but then again, they already have a guy like that on the roster, I guess, right? His name is Brock Lesnar. He also failed a test for steroids last year and gets paid multiples of what everybody else does, you know, for more than half the work. So I guess I don't really have a leg to stand on here if my argument is, you know, not to bring Jon Jones in for all the reasons I just mentioned, given that I am a Brock Lesnar fan. I guess I don't really have a leg to stand on now, do I? It's not going to happen. I mean, he's under contract to UFC. This is all pie in the sky anyway. I mean, unless, look, UFC, if this all goes through and he gets banned, they could just wash their hands of the guy and cut him. I don't know that they would. I don't think they want him going to Bellator when he comes back. But, you know, hey, people can fantasy book the match if they want. I don't see it happening. I can't say I'm a big fan of it. I personally really just don't like Jon Jones. That's me. But I guess, you know, in terms of excuses why you would not want to do the match, you know, unless you're of the opinion that Brock Lesnar shouldn't be in WWE for all the same reasons, I guess there really is no reason not to do it if it's going to be big business, and I'm sure it would do big business for them. Me, myself, though, I'm not a fan of that idea. The final Twitter poll results for SummerSlam, we had over 4,600 votes cast. The final tally was 49% thumbs up, 51% thumbs down. So just barely, you know, almost a totally even split. If you want to hear my full review, I'm not going to get into all my SummerSlam thoughts. I did an hour-long plus review of it up on the YouTube channel as a sound-off extra last weekend, actually last Monday. You can check it out. It's on the YouTube channel. Last I checked, we may be over that at this point as you are listening to this. But as I'm recording this, we are just shy of 100,000 people who have already watched my SummerSlam review. Remember WrestleMania 7 when they were building that up? They aired a commercial during WrestleMania 6 for WrestleMania 7 the following year. It was going to be at the LA Coliseum. Remember Vince McMahon made the big pitch for it, the more than 100,000 screaming fans, which turned out to be 20,000 in a smaller building. Well, we've got 100,000 screaming fans who watched the SummerSlam review on YouTube. So, and that makes it, by the way, the second most watched video on the entire channel. This is despite the fact that it made no money since YouTube decided to demonetize it as soon as it went up. It's just ridiculous. They claimed it's not advertiser-friendly. Then so I appealed it, of course, and then I get an email from them on Wednesday. So this is like at least 2 days later, 3 days later, I get an email from them telling me that they reviewed it manually, and it is, in fact, advertiser-friendly. It's okay. That's nice. Now it's okay to run ads on the video. That does me a lot of good. Thanks a lot, YouTube. Hell of an operation you've got there. Also, thank you to everybody who sent in all the great feedback on my 2K18 launch party video. I posted that as well on the YouTube channel. It's got all my interviews with Kurt Angle, WWE Champion Jinder Mahal, the newest addition to the SmackDown Live roster, Bobby Roode. We're going to talk about him a little bit later. Braun Strowman, Bayley, Alexa Bliss. I had the chance to speak to all of them. And I also want to take a moment to thank SEScoops.com, Webmaster Mike, for all of his help. He was my designated cameraman for the event. I can't tell you how many hours it took me to edit that video just the way I wanted it to look. But I think it turned out pretty well. So check it out if you missed it. Give it a like if you would be so kind. Monday Night Raw this past week was live from the Barclays Center here in Brooklyn, New York. Raw Twitter poll over 2,600 votes. 54% thumbs up, 46% thumbs down. More liked it than not, but Not overwhelming like here for this show. John Cena's back. John Cena's back on Raw. They are wasting no time, seemingly, in building to a match between him and Roman Reigns. Possibly as early as the No Mercy pay-per-view next month. There's an outside chance, I guess. It could be John Cena against Samoa Joe, and maybe they hold off on the Cena-Reigns match. Joe was part of the tag team main event on this show. He did get some in-ring time with Cena for the first time. It was Joe and Miz against John Cena and Roman Reigns in the main event. Kurt Angle introduced John Cena as his surprise on this show to chance of John Cena sucks, just like old times. This after Kurt Angle came out to his usual chance of you suck. Apparently everybody on this show sucks. Roman Reigns came out later on, they had chance of you both suck. to him and Cena in the ring. Apparently everybody on this show sucks. Roman went face-to-face with Cena. Cena says he was there in part to go face-to-face with Roman. Roman beat him to the punch. He came out. He said, you know, the only time that you're looking for me is when you're running your mouth on Twitter. Reigns, of all people, by the way, is one to talk about running his mouth on Twitter. Cena took his shirt off. He's like, I'm not here to talk. And that's when Miz came out with his whole entourage, cut this really good promo. It was actually 1 year to the day this week. It was the 1 year anniversary of that epic promo he cut on Daniel Bryan on that episode of Talking Smack. Miz complained here about how many chances Cena and Reigns get. Where's my moment? Where's my moment? That's what Miz wanted to know. And the fans chanted, you deserve it at him, which made me laugh. He got really animated during this whole thing. By the way, Meltzer says that Miz was pissed after what happened last Sunday, that empty arena match that he participated in with the Hardy Boys and Jason Jordan. I'll say this, and I said this in my SummerSlam review. It was embarrassing. It was embarrassing that they put that match on that early in the pre-show with nobody in the building. He has every right to be pissed off. And you could, you know, there's a lot of different excuses why that happened. A lot of you pointed out to me that on the ticket, and I didn't even notice this on my ticket, I didn't get to the show until well into the pre-show because I was coming from another event. But it was pointed out that on the ticket, the original call time was later than the time in which the pre-show started, because it was probably a late decision for them to expand the pre-show to 2 hours. If that's the case, that's on WWE. You know, but there were a lot of different reasons why people weren't in the building at the time. People were doing other things. The call time was later. Some people said they were stuck outside trying to get into the building. Whatever the reason was, you would think that somebody in WWE would have enough foresight to say, look, we have The Miz, who is our Intercontinental Champion, right? He's not the biggest star on the roster, but he's a pretty big name. You've got the Hardy Boys. Those are pretty big names. They're a pretty big attraction. Why in God's name do you put them on that early in the pre-show when there is nobody in the building? There was a shot of Miz, I don't remember if it was during the match or when the match was over, after he had already won, outside the ring, jaw-jacking with somebody in the front row. There was nobody, there was one person. There was nobody else. And somebody said that it was the WWE social media person, the one guy in the shot. There was nobody else around. That's embarrassing. That's Bush League. That's Mickey Mouse. That should never happen with a company like this. So he has every right to be pissed off. I wouldn't be surprised if if he channeled some of that anger here in this segment. That's what made the promo so great. I mean, he was really animated during this thing. Samoa Joe walked out. He said he would be Miz's partner against Batman and Superman over here. So in the main event, Joe has Cena locked in the Coquina clutch. Reigns goes for the Superman punch, but Joe moves out of the way. Reigns hits Cena with the punch. Miz goes in for the kill. Cena hits him with the AA, gets the pin. Cena stared down Roman Reigns when the match was over. He wasn't very happy. It sure does look like they're not waiting. They're going to do this match at the next pay-per-view, which, if they do, that tells me that Reigns is locked in for that championship match with Brock Lesnar at WrestleMania next year, that Vince is sticking to his plan. Because really, that would be the place to do the match with Cena, would be WrestleMania. If they're going to blow it off this early, I know Cena's really busy, he's doing movies and all, and TV shows and all this other stuff. You got to know that John Cena is going to be at WrestleMania next year. Certainly, if they wanted to do Cena Reigns, they could do it there. If they're not, to me, that all but confirms we're looking at Lesnar and Reigns as the main event for WrestleMania next year. But here we have Cena and Reigns, the battle of who the fans hate the least. A match where there are no winners. Very different than, say, Hogan versus Warrior back in the day. Although, I have to be fair, let's be honest. If we're being completely honest here, if you replace the fans back then with today's fans, they would be chanting, "You both suck" at Hulk Hogan and the Ultimate Warrior. The way Warrior used to just no-sell everybody, and for as long as Hogan was on top, you don't think people were sick and tired of Hogan? Even back then in 1991, 1992, people started to turn on Hogan. Can you imagine if you had the fans of today back then, if you had social media back then? People venting about Hogan all the time. I'm sick of this guy. He never puts anybody over. He's got five moves. He sucks. If you don't think those guys would be treated the exact same way, you're out of your mind. I thought the opening segment with Brock Lesnar and Braun Strowman was exactly what it needed to be. Lesnar did a fantastic job, I thought, at SummerSlam of making Strowman look like an absolute beast. He did it again here. Strowman came out. He grabbed Lesnar by the throat. I thought he was going for a choke slam. Lesnar slipped out. Braun gave him a power slam. Brock sold it like death. He was struggling to get to his feet. Strowman laid him out with another power slam. Strowman posed with the championship, and the people roared with approval. So the match is now official. It will be Brock Lesnar against Braun Strowman for the Universal Championship at No Mercy. And I'll say, you know, if they headline No Mercy with Lesnar against Strowman for the championship, and let's say Joe against Cena, or especially if they do Cena Reigns on that show, that's a pretty big double bill for that pay-per-view. Enzo Amore finally got a win over Big Cass. Unfortunately, it was by forfeit. After Cass suffered an injury, he was not able to finish the match. Seeing somebody get hurt is never funny, but I do find it amusing that the only way for Enzo to get a win on this show is when his opponent goes down with an injury. Because that is the only reason Enzo Amore won this match. I mean, we'll never know what the actual planned finish of that match was. I will bet the farm. I will guarantee everything that the outcome was not going to be an Enzo Amore win here. But he got a win, nonetheless. Before the injury, it was all Cass. He went for a big boot. What happened is that Enzo ducked, and Cass went tumbling out of the ring. He landed very awkwardly on his leg. He did try to continue the match, but when he tried to go for the Empire Elbow, he bounced off the ropes very gingerly, went to go jump up in the air, couldn't jump. He could not put any weight at all on his right knee. He just sort of collapsed into an Indian, Indian style. Referee called for the bell. Cass was just cursing up a storm in the ring. He suffered, as it turned out, a torn ACL and also possibly a medial meniscus tear. He had surgery a few days ago. He has already started rehab. An ACL tear carries a likely recovery time of 6 to 9 months. I think that's the same injury that Seth Rollins had that kept him out for all those months. And that sucks for Cass. It really does. I was not a fan of a lot of the stuff they've been doing lately with him and Enzo. It didn't appeal to me at all. I thought the match he had with Big Show at SummerSlam sucked. I thought that was I thought that was the worst match on the entire show. I can't even say it was Randy Orton Rusev, even though that went 10 seconds, because at least it was over quickly. That was more angering than anything else. But as a match that went on for, you know, a certain length of time, I thought that was the worst thing on the entire show. That being said, I didn't want to see the guy get hurt. And I do think that he can be a money player one day. He's not there yet. But you got to know this is a big opportunity for him. This is the first big singles push of his career. And for him to not only get hurt, but suffer an injury like that, that's a painful injury. And that's a tough injury to come back from. He's got a lot of grueling rehab ahead of him. I feel bad for the guy, but it's one of those freak things that could happen to anybody. Look what happened to Rollins, right? Look how it happened with him. He was wrestling Kane. He did a sunset flip off the top rope, landed on his feet, and just the way he landed. Look how Edge got hurt when he suffered that ruptured Achilles tendon, which is another really awful injury. All those years ago, right? Wasn't that a house show match? About a minute into the match, he did a leapfrog. I don't remember if I think Jeff Hardy... Was Jeff Hardy in the ring with him? I think it might have been Jeff Hardy. Whoever it was, somebody came at him, charged at him. Edge did a simple leapfrog. Came down wrong on his foot, ruptured his Achilles. Out for 7, 8, 9 months, whatever it was. And these are injuries that also could slow you down, right? So I think Rollins has looked pretty good of late. It's hard to say, though. I still look at Rollins as being, not exactly the same as he was before the injury. I thought maybe before the injury he was a little more explosive, a little faster. So maybe he's a shade slower than he used to be. But these injuries can have a long-lasting impact, especially if maybe they don't heal properly. So hopefully everything went well with the surgery. Hopefully everything goes okay with the rehab. I wish the guy nothing but the best, but can't say I was a big fan of what they had him doing lately. If I'm looking for a silver lining in all this... You let all that time go by, 9 months or whatever it ends up being. when he is ready to come back, they could always put Enzo with him as a manager. I just got done talking about this a week or two ago. I still maintain the best role for Enzo Amore is as a manager, as a mouthpiece for Big Cass. I think you keep the two of them together, but you keep Enzo out of the ring and let him run his mouth and take bumps, and that's really the best role for him. And it would have been a convoluted explanation had Enzo turned heel at SummerSlam. Some people thought maybe he would. Maybe that's why he was in the match. As it turned out, he served no purpose in the match whatsoever other than to annoy people. I got so many tweets from people. I couldn't hear it from where I was sitting, but I got so many tweets telling me, oh my God, you're so be thankful you're not watching this on TV, because apparently Enzo wouldn't shut up for the entire match. So I don't know what purpose that served in the end. But again, look for the silver lining here. All that time goes by, you could always put the two of them back together. For now, they have moved Enzo over to 205 Live. He debuted, interrupting Neville on Tuesday night as he, this was after he beat Akira Tozawa in the rematch of their rematch from SummerSlam. And Enzo told him that 205 Live just became the realest show in the room. As laughable as I find the idea of Enzo Amore challenging Neville for the Cruiserweight title, it's probably the right move for him, I guess, you know, short of shipping him back to NXT, which I also think could have worked. Probably is the best move for him at this point. We'll still see him on Raw, right? Most of those 205 guys pop up on Raw anyway. And if they think that Enzo can bring more viewers to 205 Live, then you know what? More power to him. I know in the Observer rankings a couple of weeks ago for the most watched shows that week on the WWE Network. Again, I think this goes back a couple of weeks. 205 Live didn't even crack the top 10. Again. In fact, more people that week watched an episode of NXT from August 2nd than the first run episode of 205 Live that same week. Many times, 205 Live has been beaten out by old pay-per-views from 20 years ago. It may well be a good show. I can't say I've been tuning in of late to 205 Live. If I hear there's a great match, I'll watch it. But, you know, it could be the best show in the world. The fact is, nobody's watching it. Very few people are watching it. Maybe they'll watch if Enzo's there. We'll find out. Emma was squashed in about 2 minutes with a Samoan drop by Nia Jax. If Emma is still employed in this company a year from now, I will be stunned. Elias Samson said that he looked into the eclipse, the solar eclipse, earlier that day, and it made everything crystal clear. Joey Badass looked directly into the eclipse, didn't wear any glasses, and had to cancel 3 of his upcoming tour dates. So Elias is a lucky man. He pinned R-Truth. What the hell ever happened to Goldust, by the way, finding a new protege at SummerSlam? Wasn't that the story? There was going to be like a big audition. He was going to be watching closely or, you know, picking someone or something like that. I almost think it's too bad that Rusev is on SmackDown. At this point, I kind of wouldn't mind a comedy pairing with him and Goldust. Because I've given up on the idea of them doing anything serious with Rusev. Whatever beef they have with him, it's very obvious that it's not going away anytime soon. And there's rumors flying around he wants out or he's asked for his release. I don't know if that's true, but certainly he has seen better days on the main roster. And at this point, I would take a comedy pairing of him and Goldust. Kind of like what Goldust used to do with Booker T. Because Rusev is an entertaining guy. I watched, by the way, the new season of Southpaw Regional Wrestling. I loved it. But I was disappointed that we didn't get any more Big Bartholomew. He was one of the highlights of that first season. But he's a very entertaining guy when he's doing stuff like that. And I think, I don't know, I think a pairing with him and Goldust could actually be kind of fun. Him just being completely appalled by Goldust every single week. Be better than what they have him doing now. Rollins and Ambrose beat the Hardy Boys in a non-title match. Pretty good match, actually. I was surprised they gave this away so quickly, but that's kind of what they do these days. That's what happens when you have 3 hours of television to fill. Jeff took the fall after Rollins hit him with the Kingslayer. Thank you to everybody who pointed out the name of the move to me. I believe it is the Kingslayer. And then Dirty Deeds from Dean Ambrose. Sasha Banks came out. She got boos. Not a lot of booze, but she got some noticeable booze from the people here in Brooklyn. I don't know what she expected when the first words out of her mouth were, "I may be from Boston." It's like, you may as well wear a sign around your neck that says, "Suck it, New York." So, of course, she got booed. Alexa Bliss came out. She pointed out something that I had not been aware of. In the four times that Sasha Banks has now held the Raw Women's Championship, she has yet to successfully defend that title a single time. So Alexa is going to cash in on her rematch for the championship on Raw tomorrow night. I think Sasha will finally get that elusive successful title defense. That's a pretty wild stat, though. I had not realized that. I also don't think they want to rack up too many wins for Sasha yet, because I do think that they want that for Charlotte. I do think they want Charlotte to have sort of like a Ric Flair type thing where Flair won 16 titles, and so Charlotte's going to win a whole bunch of titles. Sasha's already had it four times. I think she'll hold on to this for a little bit. Finn Balor beat Jason Jordan with the Sling Blade Dropkick Double Foot Stomp combo. There was at least one beach ball bouncing around during this match that did end up at ringside. You know, this is probably as good a time as any to address all the beach ball stuff. I love that moment at SummerSlam with Cesaro where he went into the crowd in a fit of rage, grabbed the beach ball and just tore it to shreds. I said it kind of reminded me of Fale in New Japan tearing Daryl the Cat to shreds. And Daryl, by the way, on the mend, looking good now. But the beach ball stuff was a real hot topic by the time this weekend was over. You know, is it disrespectful? Is it fun? Should they ban them? Should they keep them? If ever there was an appropriate place, I think, for there to be beach balls being thrown around, it would be during a show called SummerSlam. I'm just saying, it does kind of make sense. But by Tuesday night, WWE had had enough. According to PW Insider, they issued an edict to all of the security staff at the Barclays Center ordering that any beach balls or inflatable items, girlfriends and whatnot, be banned from the arena. If you spot them, you take them away. I saw Road Dogg tweet that it's disrespectful to all the talent. I'll tell you one talent who doesn't think it's disrespectful, John Cena. He's kind of an important guy in that company. There he was during the main event on Raw Monday night, pointing at the beach ball that was getting bounced around in the crowd, which the camera then cut to a shot of to show us, instead of ignoring it. Like when a fan jumps over the barricade, boy, they cut away awfully quick. Nope, there's the camera, focused on the beach ball. WWE even tweeted out video of it. So clearly, there is a disconnect here in how some people in that company view it as compared to other people. Cena got on the mic when the show was over. He commended the fans on their use of the beach ball. He said that there's a few security guards here that he's not too fond of, I guess, for confiscating the beach balls. And then, of course, he ended the night by, you know, kissing everybody's ass and saying, "Oh, I love that whether it's a beach ball or a wave, the fans are here to have fun." He gave his usual rah-rah speech. Here's my view on this, okay? If people want to start a wave, go for it. That's fine. They start waves at baseball games. It's not like it distracts you from enjoying the game. If a wave distracts you from enjoying a wrestling show, you know what? You're better off staying home and watching it on TV. Nobody says you have to get up and do the wave, by the way. You can let everybody else do it. So I don't have a problem with that. That's fine. It's a wrestling show. It's not opera night at Lincoln Center. With the beach balls, if you've got 4, 5, 6, 7 balls bouncing around at the same time, first of all, good for you. No, but if you've got 7 beach balls bouncing around all at the same time, or let's say one lands on you, or if one hits you in the head, then yeah, that's pretty distracting. In fact, the last time I talked about beach balls here on this podcast was only a few months ago. It was after WrestleMania this year. And I mentioned I was at that post-WrestleMania Raw, and at one point, there were 7 beach balls bouncing around at once. All bouncing around at the same time. One of which actually did hit me in the head. Now, I laughed it off. It's not like I got hit in the head with an anvil, okay? I laughed it off. But yes, that is one way to distract somebody. If they get hit in the head by something, they're going to wonder, what the hell was that? And the fact is, WWE is well within their rights to ban them if they see fit to do so. But here's the thing. And here's why the beach ball thing really doesn't bother me all that much. They have nobody to blame but themselves. I said this in April, I'll say it again now. It's their own fault. Don't blame Brooklyn. It's not our fault. First of all, I'll take the Brooklyn crowd over most of the crowds we get on that show each week. Most weeks, you'd get more of a reaction out of a building full of cadavers than you would the people who actually paid money to be there. Okay, a college lecture hall during a trigonometry class would be louder than it is in the building on Raw most weeks. So, as obnoxious as they can be, I'll gladly take the crowds in Brooklyn and Toronto and Chicago over most of those other cities. But I don't want to hear from people like Road Dogg. Ooh, Road Dogg. How disrespectful it is when the biggest star in the company is out there encouraging people to throw beach balls. I don't want to hear people like Road Dogg poo-pooing when the very company he works for cuts to a crowd shot of people throwing beach balls. Or doing the wave. Road Dogg loves to, he goes on Twitter, he says all this stuff. You know what, if he feels that passionately about it, why doesn't he march his ass out to the production truck and talk to the guys in there who cut to these things in the first place? You think he does that? They have video. They have a video they air in the arena before every show. They did it SummerSlam 2. It's a great video, too. Very well produced. Thanking the fans. They end with the message, thank you. And it's all these clips of all the different fans. Angry Miz Girl is in there. And all these people, okay? And in that video, they mention beach balls. So, it's very simple. If you don't want people to throw beach balls around during your show, don't glorify it by mentioning it or showing it on TV. Don't let the face of your company go out there and encourage people to throw beach balls. Because if he's going out there and doing that, then you know what? It can't be that bad. So long as you choose to do that, it's fair game. That's how I feel about it. SmackDown Live was back at the Barclays Center the very next night. Twitter poll, almost 1,900 votes, 86% thumbs up, 14% thumbs down. A big improvement from last week's show. People seem to really like SmackDown a lot more than Raw this week. AJ Styles opened up the show with an open challenge. I really was hoping for Shelton Benjamin here. I know we got him later in the show, but to me this would have been the perfect moment to have him come out. Just because I think it would have been a great match, A. It would have been a hot start to the show. And it would have been a great way to showcase Shelton right out of the gate. You know, a lot of fans probably don't know who he is, and obviously others do, and they haven't seen him wrestle for a long, long time. And even in defeat, because I would have had him lose, I'm sure he would have lost, you know, even in defeat, it would have been a great way to establish him, I think, in a hot, competitive match as somebody to watch, as somebody meaningful on the SmackDown brand. Now, instead, we had Kevin Owens come out. That groan you heard was from me, and I wasn't even in the Barclays Center that night. They just won't let this thing go. You hope after what happened on this show, that's finally the end, but I've been saying this for weeks. You know, we ended up getting another match between these two for the U.S. title with the proviso that this be the last shot that Owens gets against AJ Styles for the championship so long as AJ was champ. So if Owens loses this match or lost this match, which he did, that would be it for him as far as U.S. title shots so long as AJ Styles has the championship. And the other stipulation here was that Owens gets to pick the special referee for the match. Now, he tried to recruit Sami Zayn to be the referee, which made no sense. And, of course, Sami turned him down. I mean, I know he went into this whole spiel about, you know, when he was talking to Sami. But the reality is, you know, Owens hates his guts. He has no reason to trust this guy. It made no sense for him to go to him, of all people, to be the referee. And, of course, like I said, Sami said no. If Sami were smart, he would have accepted. He would have said, yes, I'll do it. And then he would have screwed Owens the way that Owens, you know, did to him in NXT. But Sami's too nice of a guy to do that. Owens ended up picking Baron Corbin to be the referee after Corbin offered his services, provided that Owens gives him the first shot at the championship if you want it. Quite the impressive feat for Baron Corbin, going from Money in the Bank holder 1 week, challenging for the WWE Championship, to being a referee, all in the span of 7 days. You know, it's possible that they just realized that Corbin simply wasn't ready to be the champion. Maybe they had buyer's remorse. There have been WWE writers. I think Kevin Eck said that Vince, many times before, has had buyer's remorse on these people after they give them the briefcase. So maybe that was just the situation here. Maybe they realize, you know what, we made a mistake. This guy's not ready, or, you know, we don't have plans for him yet to be the champion, and so let's just get the briefcase off of him in the quickest way possible. You know, it's possible that something like that did happen. I'm not sure wrestling, you know, AJ Styles, if that's the next step for Corbin, is a demotion. If people want to look at it that way, I'm not so sure about that, because AJ, to me, is still the best in the entire company, from an in-ring perspective anyway, in terms of getting good matches out of people. And also, I would argue that the U.S. title is more prominently featured on this show than the WWE title is. So we'll see if that's the direction that we go in. If it is going to be AJ Styles against Baron Corbin next, I'm not sure what else they do with Corbin right now. He did not come out of the last 2 weeks looking good at all. So, you know, is he buried? Is he just sort of demoted because they didn't want to pull the trigger on him yet and he'll be okay? You know, maybe 6 months they'll revisit it. Who knows? You know, all these stories about him and Cena. There was a rumor that John Cena didn't like his attitude and went to Vince McMahon to let him know it. I don't know if that's true or not. I have my doubts. But you know what? It got me thinking. Kevin Eck, I mentioned his name a little while ago. He is a former WWE writer. And he has shared some very interesting stories in his blog online about stories from his days working in creative. He has told the story of John Cena telling Vince McMahon after working with Dolph Ziggler, this would have been probably 2012, I guess, going to Vince and saying that this guy doesn't have it as a headliner. Dolph just doesn't have it. And Vince already didn't see Dolph on that level, so Cena coming to him and saying that didn't help Dolph at all. And that was pretty much the kiss of death for Ziggler, because Vince so values John Cena's opinion that he basically just gave up on the idea of Dolph Ziggler being in a headline position on the show. According to him, that did happen. So it's very plausible that John Cena maybe said something similar about Corbin, but it makes me wonder, you know, if John Cena ever felt that way about Roman Reigns and went to Vince McMahon about it, what would Vince do? Who would he side with? Because Roman's been awfully vocal himself on Twitter lately, insulting fans. You know, John Cena's always played it cool, very respectful, even though you got to think he would love one of these days just to go off on people who talk crap about him. He doesn't do it. Like on social media and everything, he's always very respectful, very, very buttoned down, straight-laced. What would Vince do? It would be like that scene from the movie The Good Son with a young Macaulay Culkin, where the mother is hanging on to the two kids at the end of the movie, just hanging on to them for dear life. They're dangling off the edge of a cliff. She can only save one of them, right? She's losing her grip. She has to choose one over the other. Like, let's say Vince is the dad in this situation. He's got Cena by one hand. He's got Roman by the other. He's got to let one go. Who does he choose? It's an interesting question. Anyway, Styles and Corbin got into it during the main event with Styles and Owens. Shane McMahon ran down to yell at Baron Corbin. Corbin said, the hell with this. He ripped off the referee shirt, handed it to Shane. Shane put the referee shirt on. Owens had a meltdown at this. And when he got back in the ring, AJ hit him with the phenomenal forearm, and he got the pin to retain the championship. I never thought I would say this, but if there was no other matches this year between Kevin Owens and AJ Styles, like for the rest of the year, I would be totally okay with that. Especially when most of them have had these very convoluted BS finishes. Like, I feel most of their matches have been good, to very good even, but none of them have been particularly memorable. None of the finishes have been particularly memorable. They've all been convoluted and just, you know, nonsense to lead to the next match. It's very obvious at this point they're going to do something with Owens and Shane at the next pay-per-view. Maybe they'll do it inside Hell in a Cell. Depends how many cell matches they want to do on the pay-per-view this year. Do they do just a WWE Championship cell match? Do they do two or three cell matches, which I think would be overkill? We'll wait and see. That pay-per-view isn't until October. SmackDown did get a bit more glorious this week with the debut of Bobby Roode. He has finally made it after all these years, 40 years old now, right? 41. Made it to the WWE roster. He is apparently a babyface now, which is weird. I would think this is only temporary and he'll be a heel soon enough. He should be a heel. I hope he's a heel. Even his post-match promo sounded very heelish. He was very full of himself. He called himself the hottest free agent in sports entertainment. He says, everything I do is big box office. He beat Aiden English. Yeah, it was a good debut. People were very much into Bobby Roode, as you would expect them to be in Brooklyn. It's kind of like the post-WrestleMania crowd. People debut, they get a big reaction. The key is going to be next week, whatever city they're in, and the week after that, and the week after that. Can they maintain that? I do want to bring up Ziggler. I mentioned him a little while ago. Dolph Ziggler reemerged here on this show. He hasn't been on TV for many weeks. I guess he asked for time off, and it was granted. He talked about how lame it was that his big return was in a backstage interview segment. He's been watching Raw and SmackDown. He says, and I realize now that in order to be a star in this company, I need to start singing and playing the guitar. Or maybe I should get myself a fancy robe. And I took that to mean that he may be feuding next with Bobby Roode, especially since Roode now is a babyface. But then again, Ziggler also said that he may have to get himself a woman to escort him to the ring who glows in the dark. So maybe he'll feud with Jimmy Uso instead. Who knows? The better question is, who cares? Who cares? Ziggler at this point, talented as he is just a lost cause. And to me, I see Ziggler's role going forward being what it was in the feud with Nakamura. He'll work with new guys on the brand and, you know, work a match or maybe a couple of matches with them and help give them a big win and help get them over to the next level and get people to take them seriously. That's the role I envisioned for him going forward. He did it with Nakamura. Perhaps he'll do it now with Bobby Roode. Backstage, Daniel Bryan told Chad Gable that in making the deal to bring Jason Jordan to Raw, Raw GM Kurt Angle helped Bryan sign an old friend of his, which turned out to be Shelton Benjamin, former member of Team Angle back in the day. Benjamin got a nice reaction when he popped up on screen. Gable started marking out. He's talking about, oh my God, Shelton Benjamin, I've been following your entire career. So they're going to be tag team partners going forward. Benjamin ended the segment by telling Bryan, we'll see how this goes. Look, it's wouldn't have been my first choice for what to do with Gable. Just, you know, Jason Jordan disappears. Let's replace one guy with another, plug another, you know, guy in there. It's better than Gable being used as a sacrificial lamb for a guy who lost at the pay-per-view 5 days later in 10 seconds to Randy Orton. That's not the role I want for Chad Gable going forward. And so this is an improvement. This is better. This at least means that they're going to try to do something with him and he'll get more TV time. And God knows they could use more tag teams, right? I've made that point before. They're pretty weak, especially on the SmackDown side right now in terms of tag teams. So maybe Gable and Benjamin will really gel and have good chemistry and they'll hit it off and maybe they'll even win the tag team titles at some point. And at some point down the road, you know, Benjamin can turn on him and they can have a singles feud. So I'm okay with that idea. We had Shinsuke Nakamura against the Singh brothers in a 2-on-1 handicap match. Nakamura won by submission with a choke. Jinder Mahal attacked Nakamura after the match. Nakamura, though, laid him out with the Kinshasa, which should have been the finish at SummerSlam. They did it here. I can't say I'm looking forward to the rematch, honestly, if the match at SummerSlam that they had is any indication. But clearly they're headed in that direction. One would hope that the outcome this time would be different. I can't see Mahal beating Nakamura just straight up, fair and square, no interference, no foreign objects, no ref bumps or any of that stuff. So if Mahal's going to retain again in the next pay-per-view match, then they're just repeating the same finish over and over and over again. Every time it's the Singh brothers getting involved. You know, that gets old after a while. I'm not sure what other creative way they could come up with to have Nakamura lose in an unclean way to Jinder Mahal. So to me, you put the two of them in the ring together and you do the title change. This has run its course. It is time to make a move. And that was it. That was the key stuff on this show. It was a newsworthy show with Bobby Roode debuting and Shelton Benjamin coming back. It's good to have some fresh faces on the program, especially, and I hope that was the blow-off. I really do, between Owens and Styles. because I've seen enough, and it's time for both those guys to move on. No sign of Mike Bennett and Maria on this show, which I guess is not surprising, but boy, you know, there's a lot of rumors flying around about why Bennett is not getting a push right now, and who knows what the actual reason is. You would think that if it had to do with his physique, I've heard that, that they knew what they were getting when they signed him, but, you know, whatever it is, there's an example of an act that probably would have been better off on NXT before coming to the main roster. Because a lot of times we'll hear that they sign guys and we're like, oh man, we hope they just go right to the main roster. Like when AJ Styles signed, it was like, they can't possibly put this guy in NXT. AJ is good enough to be on the main roster. And they did the right thing. They debuted him in the Royal Rumble, and AJ was the MVP in that company for all of 2016. He may end up being the MVP for 2017 when all is said and done. Some guys just completely bypass NXT. Some guys don't. Some guys spend 2-3 years down there like Balor did. And I think Sami Zayn was down there for like 3 or 3.5 years. There's no rhyme or reason. Look at Braun Strowman. Braun Strowman technically was in NXT. If you remember his days as a Rosebud, he popped up as a Rosebud a few times. But he never really had a run in NXT. He went right to the main roster as a member of the Wyatt family. Very little experience. And look at him now. He has improved tremendously. Some people go from NXT to the main roster and have no business being on the main roster. And it really screws them over, because if you would just keep them down in NXT, which was originally intended to be the developmental brand, even though now it's really not, but, you know, they get more experience and they improve and they get better, and then hopefully when it is time for them to make it to the main roster, they're better off for it. They've screwed some people up by moving them up too quickly. You know, now we have Adam Cole and Red Dragon in NXT, and I think they'll do well there, and whenever they see fit to move them up, they'll move up. But Bennett and Maria, as it turned out, probably would have been a lot better off just starting out down in NXT, and I think immediately debuting on the main roster, unlike an AJ Styles, unlike a Braun Strowman, turned out to be maybe the death knell for this guy. And that's a shame. And Maria especially, even more than Bennett. I mean, Maria is a hot act. You put her with anybody, let her create her own stable. You know, I mean, you could do a lot with her, and she's got a lot of appeal in many different ways. She's a pretty good talker. She's a good performer. And so her, even more so than Bennett, it's a shame to just see her be completely wasted like this.
I'm actually not wearing pants, and that's how I watch NXT every single week.
Vacant strikes again. That's two titles in 1 week. First the GFW title, and now the NXT Women's title. Yes, Asuka is no longer the NXT Women's Champion. Her record-setting reign has come to an end after more than 500 days. Not by pinfall or submission, but by forfeit. Earlier in the week, WWE announced that Asuka broke her right collarbone in her match with Ember Moon at TakeOver. They said she landed awkwardly from a throw by Ember Moon. A typical recovery time from an injury like a broken collarbone is said to be 6 to 8 weeks, which would have had her back in time before the next TakeOver show, since that show isn't until November, which is about 12 weeks away. I was hopeful they would not strip her. I was hoping they wouldn't. But strip her they have. WWE already announced it, so it's not really a spoiler. At the NXT tapings this week, they had an in-ring segment where Asuka handed over the championship after noting that William Regal has begun negotiations to move Asuka to either Raw or SmackDown. So she is, in fact, moving up to the main roster. They had the entire locker room come out to applaud her. Triple H gave her flowers the way that he did with Bayley after Bayley beat Sasha in that Iron Man match at Full Sail. According to Ryan Satin, she is being moved to the Raw brand, which sent a cold shiver up my spine when I read that. Now, on the one hand, I do kind of want to see Asuka and Sasha Banks have a feud. I just feel like the two of them, I think they would work well together, and I actually would want to see that match. And then if Paige comes back, Paige and Asuka, I think, is another potentially interesting match on the Raw side. On the other hand, it's Raw, right? We see what they've done with Bayley. We see what they've done with Emma. Two women who were very much over with the crowd at Full Sail came to Raw, and they have largely just crashed and burned. Obviously, Bayley has had more success than Emma has, but if you look at where Bayley was and where she is now, forget the injury, that's a pretty big indictment, I think, on her her treatment, her booking, call it whatever you want to, on the Raw brand so far. It's not a good thing. Now, Asuka has been heavily protected down at NXT her entire run. She's never been beaten. She's always been made to look like a force to be reckoned with. But as we well know, how you're booked in NXT is not necessarily how Vince McMahon will handle you once you make your way to the main roster. I would hope that they see what they've got with her. I'm sure Triple H does. What Triple H thinks apparently doesn't really matter all that much when it comes to the main roster. Apparently it doesn't matter all that much when it comes to Raw. I'm sure he knows exactly what he has with Asuka and how much of a, you know, as far as business goes, and with her being unbeaten, I think that she's a money player for them. She's a money player just waiting in the wings. Does Vince McMahon realize that? Does Vince McMahon see her the same way? That's the question. How much influence does Triple H have on Vince McMahon? We're about to find out. Now, I would hope they recognize what they have with her and this undefeated streak and all that. They could still do Asuka and Charlotte. I saw there were some people who were disappointed. They were hoping that they would do that match. Now they can't. There's no law that says they can't. It's very easy to do that. You can do that match at WrestleMania. Very easy it would be to book a one-time only special attraction interbrand match if that's the direction they wanted to go in. I hope they keep her unbeaten at least until WrestleMania. Milk that thing for all it's worth. It's a hell of a lot more meaningful than that dumb pay-per-view streak that Charlotte had going a few months ago. People lost their mind when she was finally beaten, and it's like, it's a freaking pay-per-view streak. Who cares? Who cares? You know? This is a much bigger deal than that. So the question now becomes also, what happens with the NXT Women's Championship? They didn't announce what their plans were at the tapings, so we still don't know. We do know they have the first round of the Mae Young Classic, dropping tomorrow, this Monday, on the WWE Network. The live finals are set to air September 12th, I believe from Vegas. They could just award the championship to the winner of the tournament if they wanted to, but to me, you know, storyline-wise, that's pretty unfair to all the women that are on the NXT active roster, like Ember Moon and Peyton Royce and people like that who weren't even in the tournament. You don't want two women's tournaments simultaneously, so the idea of doing the Mae Young Classic and at the same time having a tournament on NXT for the championship, that doesn't really appeal to me all that much. Maybe the thing that makes the most sense to do is to do a Battle Royal. Do a Battle Royal on NXT in a few weeks with the winner wrestling the winner of the Mae Young Classic at the next TakeOver show in November for the vacant championship. And the winner of that match becomes the new NXT Women's Champion. I think something like that could work. You know, I was looking at the women's roster on NXT as far as who you would include in a battle royal. I think 10 women, that's a nice even number to use. You've got Ember Moon, you've got Peyton Royce, you've got Billie Kay, Nikki Cross, Ruby Riott. They've got Liv Morgan, Mandy Rose, Aaliyah. So that's 8. And they could find two more women. I mean, they've used Rachel Ellering before, Tessa Blanchard, that would be 10. And you do a battle royal. But, again, that's just one idea. We'll see what they do. You know what? Since I brought it up, speaking of the Mae Young Classic, I have to talk about this. WWE.com had a feature on Piper Niven. She wrestled as Viper in ICW and a lot of promotions overseas. And I think, like, in Europe or Scotland, Ireland, like, areas like that. And she's apparently very, very talented. I've had people email me and say, oh, she's one to watch out for. I'm really not all that familiar with her work, but people have raved about her. But WWE posted a link on their Facebook page to this video. It was like a getting to know you kind of video about her. And they posted a link on their Facebook page. And my God, the comments on this, it's not even really an article, but on the link. I am embarrassed to be a wrestling fan. That was my first thought. I'm scrolling through the comments. I'm like, I was beat red. You know that gif of Homer Simpson just backing into the bush? That was me. It's like, all the fat-shaming comments, just one after the other after the other. Like, this is not even like, oh, she's a heavy woman, or she's fat, or all this stuff. This is like really personal stuff, like one after the other after the other. And I've been warned, like some of you guys have warned me before about these WWE Facebook pages and the official superstar pages they have on Facebook and all that kind of stuff. I mean, I've been warned about YouTube comment sections before, but I didn't think it was this bad. I didn't realize how bad it really was. What a friggin' disgrace. I'm sure all those people must be a delight to look at. But yeah, avoid that at all costs if you can. WWE formally announced the signing of Lio Rush this week. They had an article up on WWE.com about it. Mentioned that he won the Ring of Honor Top Prospect Tournament in 2016. That's another top prospect winner that they've got on their way into WWE soon, right? Donovan Dijak is another one. He won the tournament a couple of years ago. There's one already on the SmackDown roster, Mike Bennett. I think he may have won the first top prospect tournament they had. Hopefully Lio has better luck than Bennett has so far. But one thing he has going for him is that he's going to debut first in NXT. So he should be thankful and grateful for that. It also mentioned that Lio is a former CZW heavyweight champion. It's kind of weird to think of a 160-pound guy as a heavyweight, but whatever. He was also tag team champions, the article pointed out, with Patrick Clark, who is now known as the Velveteen Dream in NXT. They were in Maryland Championship Wrestling as tag team champions together. .com also had an entirely separate story they did on Lio Rush, devoted to him meeting Topanga from Boy Meets World at that PWG show a few months ago. I talked about that here on the podcast. That was the one where she ended up buying the last shirt that he brought with him. I saw that Topanga actually tweeted him after the news broke of him signing with WWE. She tweeted him and said that she'll happily brag that she knew him before the big time, and she congratulated him. They totally need to bring her in as his manager. I'm just saying, they should bring her in as his... Why not? Give me one good reason why not, right? Girl Meets World got canceled, so that show's not on anymore. She's an actress. She can act her way through the part. She didn't even have to be a big wrestling fan. That's who cares, right? I mean, they brought Lana in to manage Rusev. Where do you think she came from? You think she came when she was such a big wrestling fan back in the day? Where do you think they found her? She was an actress. I bet you she'd do it, too. She would totally do it. Lio Rush, managed by Topanga. That's a winning act right there. NXT this week, I don't really have a lot to say. I mean, it was mostly a recap show from TakeOver, the matches they did air. I already reviewed them last week here on the show. I was there. I saw those matches live. I will say this, you know, watching it back here on the network, as loud as that pop was on TV for Pete Dunne, you had to be there in the building to truly appreciate how loud it was when he first came out. Easily got the biggest reaction out of all four guys. The guy has star written all over him. I hope they realize that. I also hope we start seeing some UK title defenses. We need more of these guys, not less. And somebody sent in a mailbag question about the UK guys. I'm going to talk a little bit more about this, so I'll save it for that. As far as Team ROH goes, that's not their name, but I'm calling them that. I did not read any of the spoilers from the tapings that they did this week beyond the Asuka stuff, which they spoiled themselves. But I figured that this is just my guess. I assume that the direction they're going in is sort of the Horseman thing with the Evolution deal, right? Where Adam Cole eventually beats Drew McIntyre to win the NXT Championship. Red Dragon wins the tag team titles from Sanity. In fact, I think the only reason that Eric Young and Alexander Wolfe even won the tag team belts from AOP was to be transitional champions and get the belts onto Bobby Fish and Kyle O'Reilly. And they'll probably just end up holding all the belts. Lucha Underground. If you remember, I didn't get a chance to talk about Lucha Underground at all last week, and I was going to watch it anyway because I want to be all caught up, but some of you emailed me and said, you got to watch the end, and now I see why. They had a wild brawl to end the show last week, which it was crazy. It actually felt more like a prison riot than anything else. Everything just broke down. Every superstar came out. All these little feuds they had going on, like Killshot and Dante Fox, right? Dante Fox is like up in the balcony just watching all the mayhem, and then Killshot attacks him, and Marty the Moth gets attacked by this person. It's total chaos and pandemonium, and it was so much fun to watch. That was probably the best just chaotic wrestling brawl that I've seen, probably since the Undertaker-Brock Lesnar segment they did on Raw, which was a couple of summers ago. I mean, this was really wild stuff. So NXT this week, or Lucha Underground, I should say. Well, NXT and Lucha Underground are the two best wrestling shows on TV, in my opinion. But this week was the finals of the Cueto Cup tournament and the championship match that they've been hyping for weeks now between Johnny Mundo and Rey Mysterio. So this was kind of a big deal, this show. First, though, we got a mask versus mask match between Sexy Star and Veneno. Or at least we were supposed to. Match never got started. Joey Ryan came out. He unmasked Veneno. So much for the match stipulation. He just came down and pulled the mask right off his head. And he revealed Cortez Castro. Now, in a segment on the show the previous week, Joey Ryan had been in Dario Cueto's office and said, you know, you've got a rat here in the ranks. That guy Veneno with the spider mask, right? That's really Cortez Castro. And that's what led to the mask versus mask match. But I guess Joey just couldn't help himself. And he just ran down and pulled the mask off himself. And it was, in fact, Cortez Castro. And Castro beat the hell out of him. He went to go give him a pile driver on top of the announce desk. But Joey gave him a low blow and scampered off. So this was more of an angle than a match. I can't really call it a waste of time because it's a means to an end here. It's obviously advancing that storyline. But there was no match. Prince Puma against Pentagon Dark. In the finals of the Cueto Cup tournament, this was a hell of a match. Puma won with the 630 splash. Vampiro got in the ring after the match and held up Puma's arm because he's been a great influence on Puma, right, of late. He's been sort of guiding him. That's why we've seen this darker side of Prince Puma, where he even comes out now and wrestles in jeans every week. Dario Cueto got in the ring to present the trophy, the Cueto Cup, to the winner, Prince Puma. The cup looks... this cup is so lame. This cup looks so bootleg. I mean, all these weeks, really? And that's the best you can come up with for a trophy. Like, I remember the first time they trotted that thing out. It had, like, little tassels on the side of it. It's, like, such a stereotypical little trophy that you can find. Like, I used to use a program back in the day when I was doing graphics stuff on my computer. Like, my first computer. I had a program called the Print Shop Deluxe. That's how far back this goes. And I remember seeing, like, little trophies like that. Like, it's such a basic thing. You would think that they could spruce it up a little bit. Then again, I guess it is an underground fight club type thing. Very kind of gritty and dirty and, I don't know. Maybe it's meant to not look all that extravagant. I think their belts at, you know, like the Lucha Underground Championship is actually pretty cool. I think that's one of the more beautiful belts in all of wrestling right now. So Puma gets a shot. Here's what matters. All right, fuck the trophy. Here's what matters. Puma gets a shot at the Lucha Underground champion at Ultima Lucha 3. That's the key to all this, which leads us to this. Johnny Mundo defending the Lucha Underground championship against Rey Mysterio Jr. here in the main event. These two also had a really good match, although I like the Pentagon match more, but this was good. There was a ref bump. Mundo grabs the belt. He's going to use it. Out comes Rey Mysterio's son, Dominic. I still can't get over how big this kid is. Dominic comes out. He grabs the belt away from Mundo. Then he took Mundo down with a double leg. So security comes out. They chase Dominic off. This kid actually slugged one of the security guards. What a thug. So Mysterio hits a 619. He hits the springboard. He's got the championship won. Place is going crazy. Matt Stryker is doing, of course, what Matt Stryker does, which is marking out bro. That's what he's doing on commentary. All of a sudden, Dario Cueto reaches into the ring and he pulls out the referee. He yanks the referee out to the floor, breaks up the pin. Dario then punches Rey in the face. Rey retaliates. He goes for a 619. Mundo recovers in the meantime. He grabs the championship belt. He whacks Rey from behind with it. Gives him the end of the world, which is the corkscrew moonsault finisher that he does off the top rope. Gets the pin. Cheap finish. Really cheap finish to what I thought was a pretty good match. And the thing is, like, it's a match that this entire season has been built around for weeks and weeks. And all the video packages. Remember Michael Chavello was narrating some of the vignettes. Really just great build up to this match. And that's the finish they give us. Really? Now, on a more positive note, that means that we're going to get Prince Puma and Johnny Mundo for the championship at Ultima Lucha. I really like the all-night-long Iron Man match they had a while back. I think it was last season. I'm sure this match will kick ass. As long as we don't have another lame finish, it's going to kick ass. I look forward to seeing it. we've got to be coming to the end, that means, soon of Season 3. This was the second half of Season 3. If you remember, they took a break for a while. So I don't know if Ultima Lucha, they didn't say Ultima Lucha was like this week. So I don't think it's this week, but it's coming up pretty quick. And we still have no definitive word on a Season 4. Season 4 hasn't even been taped. You know, usually they tape this and it's in the can for months and then they air it. There hasn't been any movement on a Season 4, other than that one executive from El Rey a few weeks ago coming out and saying, you know, we're very optimistic and all we're doing right now is we're looking for a place in our lineup, which told me that they were going to move to a different time slot, which also may not be such good news. But we've heard nothing. There's been nothing concrete. There's been nothing definitive from El Rey or anyone in Lucha Underground, the writers, nobody. And that does not inspire a great deal of confidence. We're also heading into a championship match here. You've got Johnny Mundo and Rey Mysterio, right? So in Mysterio, you've got one guy who's on his way, although Mysterio is on his way out. But you've got Puma and Mundo. And in Puma, you've got one guy who's already got one foot out the door, right? He came out at that at the New Japan show talking smack about Lucha Underground. He can't wait to get the hell out of there. And you've got Mundo, who is debuting on GFW television. That also doesn't inspire a lot of confidence when it comes to a fourth season. So I'm hoping for some good news here, because I like the show. I'm still into the show, and I enjoy it, and I want to see it continue into season 4, 5, and 6. But I don't know what the hell's going on. Let's get to your mailbag questions. We'll try to do a whole bunch of them since we didn't do any of them last week. You can email me, thesolomonster, at gmail.com. Please, if you do so, include your name and where you are from when you write in. I got a bunch of questions, so I'll use this one. But a lot of you wanted me to talk about this, and so I'll talk about it up front. This one comes, though, from AJ, ironically, as you'll see in a second, AJ, from Tucson, Arizona. He sent me a link to an interview that Nikki Bella did at a Make-A-Wish event last week, where she was asked if she feels that if Total Divas gets enough credit for growing WWE's female audience. She said it doesn't, and took things one step further and said that Total Divas helped start the women's revolution. She said more women started watching WWE as a result of Total Divas, and then on the subject of why she feels Total Divas doesn't get the recognition that it deserves, she basically pointed the finger at people like AJ Lee without calling her out by name, which she's done before. Doesn't call her out by name, but clearly she's got some ill feelings towards AJ Lee. She said, this is her quote. She said, what's unfortunate is that when Total Divas was succeeding, and we became, as opposed to what, now it's not? Anyway, when Total Divas was succeeding and we became a hit reality show, they let people with a microphone in the ring just bash it, and us Total Divas never got a response. So with the fans, it began to give Total Divas a bad name. Oh, they're just reality stars. Actually, while the girls who aren't on the reality show are just wrestling, I know what a horrible thing that is, right? While those girls are just wrestling, Nikki says, us girls on the reality show are wrestling and filming and never sleeping and going to appearances and making sure that the world knows how amazing women's wrestlers are. So I don't feel Total Divas gets enough credit because the words reality show have ruined it. I don't feel Total Divas gets enough credit because certain people, also characters for the company, have ruined it out of pure jealousy. I will admit that, end quote. So that's from Nikki Bella. And I will say this, she is not wrong when she says that Total Divas helped bring in new female fans. I can tell you from personal observation, I have two friends, right? One of which is my best friend, in fact. I'm very good friends with him and his wife. Now granted, this is two people. This is a very small sample size here, but if I know two people like this, then you can bet your ass that a lot of other people know people like this. Some of you might even be listening to this right now. Two friends of mine, in one case, his wife was a lapsed fan from the Attitude Era. She used to watch Stone Cold and The Rock and The Undertaker and the NWO and all that stuff, and really didn't watch wrestling anymore. And in the other case, the guy's wife never even liked wrestling to begin with. And both of them became fans of WWE by watching Total Divas. So I absolutely believe that the show did lead to more women watching Raw and SmackDown, even if it was only to see the women and then they turned it off. Okay? I believe that. She's right. I believe she's 100% right. I can't sit here and tell you how much they've grown the audience. Is it really all that significant? I don't know the numbers on that, but it definitely has brought in some new female eyeballs. But this idea that Total Divas is responsible for the women's revolution is so comical to me. You know, if Nikki wants to start a new career in stand-up comedy, she's off to a great start. The women's revolution. First of all, thank God they stopped calling it that. But the women's revolution was primarily born out of putting on shitty 30-second Divas matches every week on TV. Where do you think my whole Divas stopwatch gimmick came from that I did for all those years? It came from the absurdity of all these short Divas matches where the women, assuming they even got an entrance, since most weeks they didn't, their entrances would last longer than the matches themselves. They would come to the ring and the referee would probably give them the go-home sign before the bell even rang. What finally, you know, got it going was that one night on Raw. Remember the whole Give Divas a Chance hashtag that got trending? That was the night that really kicked this whole thing off. Because if there's one thing that means anything to WWE, if we've learned nothing by now, it's when they trend on Twitter. Boy, do they love that. It was actually a match. It was the Bellas. I went back and looked it up. It was the Bella Twins against Paige and Emma that got this whole thing really started. That match lasted 30 seconds. If you blinked, you missed it. 30 seconds on a 3-hour show. That was routine. That wasn't a one-time fluke. That was happening all the time. 30 seconds, a minute, 90 seconds. That's what they would get. And that match was the straw that broke the camel's back. And it was a slow build from there. But after a while, they did finally start giving the women more time. That's what got things rolling. That and bringing women up who could work, which is not to say the Bella Twins, you know, can't wrestle, right? They made great improvements in their work. Go back and watch the Bellas when they first came in to how they were before they left. You cannot deny that they showed improvement. But WWE brought up women like Charlotte, brought up women like Sasha Banks and Becky Lynch. New blood. And these were not pinup models that they found in a catalog somewhere. These were women who could go. They could mix it up in there. But yeah, let me just make that clear. I'll give Nikki credit. She improved a lot from where she was when she first started. And Brie also. I know Brie was training with Daniel Bryan, and she worked hard too. And now there's talk she wants to come back. But to say that Total Divas is responsible or played any significant role in the whole Give Divas a Chance stuff is ridiculous. It is misleading. That's a polite way of putting it. It is misleading. And throwing shade at AJ Lee, let me tell you something. No, there's no one person, okay, who is responsible for this revolution or whatever the hell you want to call it. But AJ Lee did more for that whole Give Divas a Chance stuff than anything Nikki Bella ever did. Are you kidding me? And not because of the work shoot. Everybody points to the work shoot that AJ did on Raw. They call it the pipe bomb or whatever, which is another overused term. And I thought it was a great promo. I'm not even talking about that. It was a fantastic promo. It was only ruined by the Bellas and their annoying shouting. Somebody should have muzzled them during that promo. They wouldn't shut up. But it wasn't even that. It was right after the whole Give Divas a Chance stuff started trending. Who was it who went on Twitter to call out Stephanie McMahon, to call out her own boss in a very public way, I might add, because Stephanie had tweeted something about women's rights? And AJ said, wait a minute, you're saying all this stuff, and yet your women, the women in WWE, get a fraction of the wages and the screen time that a lot of the male roster gets. Yeah, you have divas that sell a ton of merch. I'm sure AJ was one of them. She would know. She was selling a bunch of t-shirts back then. She was very popular. And she said to Stephanie, you know, you have women who are selling a ton of merchandise and have been in some of the highest rated segments on the show a bunch of times. Basically calling out Stephanie for being a hypocrite. Nikki Bella didn't do that. Brie Bella didn't do that. AJ Lee did. They definitely get more screen time now. I mean, I can't speak to the wage issue, whether or not that's changed. But when I think of some of the key players involved in calling out WWE and getting things to change, I don't think of Nikki Bella. I think of AJ Lee. AJ was the first woman in years, Stephanie aside. And I guess you could probably throw Chyna in there, I guess. Although Chyna wasn't always involved in main event stuff. She was kind of doing Intercontinental and wrestling Jeff Jarrett and stuff like that. But the first woman, aside from Stephanie, really, was AJ, since Miss Elizabeth, to be involved in the main storylines on TV each week with the men. Lots of times that show, Raw, or even SmackDown, would end with her in the final segment. Then they made her the general manager for a while. Of all the women who could have talked about lack of screen time, you know what I mean? Like, she got more than most. And yet she was the one who spoke out about it on behalf of all the women. She didn't have to do that. And I know she was off TV at the time and the stuff was going on with Punk, although AJ did come back for a little bit after that. So she was kind of in limbo, but she still worked for the company. She wasn't really on bad terms with them. She was an employee just like all the rest, or I'm sorry, independent contractor, like all the rest of them were. Nobody else was speaking out, but she did. So this notion that like Total Divas and all the stuff that she and Brie did, oh, we don't get enough credit for the women's revolution. If anything, they get too much credit. I mean, think back to 2014. Think back to that awful feud and the stuff on TV with Nikki and Brie, and this was probably after the Brie-Stephanie stuff, but think back to 2014. Nikki was on TV telling her sister, I wish you would have died in the womb. Remember that great thing rolling around in there with Jerry Springer? Oh yeah, great TV. That whole storyline, that whole thing was an embarrassment. That whole thing set the women's movement in this company back a good 50 years. It wasn't until 6 months later, another 6 months worth of 30-second Divas matches, that people finally said, enough is enough. And that, as much as anything, is what led to them changing things. Brian from Orlando, since the pre-show matches that started back in 2012, do you have any memorable WWE pay-per-view pre-show matches? Yeah, actually, there's two of them. Both of them happen to involve the Usos. I always go back to this one. I was actually at that show. So maybe that's part of why I remember it so fondly, because the crowd was so up for it. But it was a great match. It was on the Money in the Bank 2013 pre-show. That was when Money in the Bank was in Philly. And there were people who were very upset even then that these guys got left off the main card. And I remember those guys were upset too. And maybe they tweeted about it or whatever, but they were like, all right, we're going to go out there and steal the show and let everybody else try to follow us. And I don't think anybody else really could. But it was the Usos against Roman Reigns and Seth Rollins of The Shield. And this was back before, you know, all the boo birds started coming out for Roman Reigns, and he was still, you know, kind of the cool guy in The Shield. But those four guys went out there, and they had a kick-ass tag team title match. So I still look at that, honestly, as being my favorite of all the pre-show matches they've done over the last, whatever it's been now, 4 or 5 years. And then I would point to last weekend at SummerSlam. You know, when they did the Usos New Day match, that was a damn good match. And this time the Usos actually won. They didn't win the first one. But I thought that match they had last weekend on the kickoff show, which I did finally make it into the building for that. I missed everything before that. But I made it in for the SmackDown tag title match. And I thought that was a really, really good match. That was one of the best matches of the entire night. So those are two right there that I think of. Keith from Los Angeles. This year, Roman Reigns defeated The Undertaker at WrestleMania. Ever since then, he lost 2 pay-per-view matches to Braun Strowman, lost in the Fatal 5-Way at Extreme Rules, and ate the pin at SummerSlam. For a person who beat Undertaker in his last match, I don't think he's being pushed like it. What do you think WWE does next with him? Yeah, that's an interesting point. Roman Reigns has not had a pay-per-view win since beating The Undertaker at WrestleMania. It's like the opposite of what they did with Brock Lesnar in 2014 when he beat The Undertaker. Now, granted, I don't think Brock had a single match since beating Undertaker. I think he went right from beating Taker to beating Cena. Somebody will correct me if I'm wrong, and he did have a match in between. But with Brock, I mean, they had to. How do you not, you know, the guy who's going to end the streak, how do you not make him out to be a big deal? So he got the monster push, and they really did everything right with Brock. I never would have broken the streak, but if you were going to do it, they did it the right way, and Brock went on just an unstoppable tear. The problem with Roman is, okay, he beat The Undertaker, right? So it's a no-win situation here, because you look at it and you go, man, this guy beat The Undertaker, and now he's been booked like a loser. He's lost every pay-per-view match since then. But if he goes out there and he wins every single pay-per-view match, people are going to be even more pissed off, and they're going to say, see, this guy wins every single match. Why doesn't he put other people over? Why doesn't he lose? So really, with the fans, I think you're in a no-win situation here. So what do they do next with Roman Reigns? Well, it looks like they're probably going to do Roman Reigns and John Cena, would be my guess. And I would have to think that Roman would come out of that the winner, or maybe they do some sort of disputed finish that leads eventually to a WrestleMania match. I don't know. If they, I'm telling you, though, if they do Reigns and Cena this early, that right there is all the indication you need that they're doing Reigns and Lesnar, with Reigns winning the championship at WrestleMania, because I don't know why you wouldn't do Reigns and Cena. The only reason you wouldn't do Reigns and Cena at Mania is because you've already got Brock and Roman lined up. Whether people like it or not, that's probably the match they're going with. You know, Vince, it looks like this time he's going to stick to his guns. What would I do with Roman? You know, look, all roads lead to the Universal Championship. I know a lot of people don't like that. They don't want to hear that. But that's the reality. Whether you like it or not, it's coming. The question is when? Is it WrestleMania? You know, does it happen sooner? I think it's probably WrestleMania. I don't see it happening before then. And if you want to make it work, I still maintain the way to make that work. And you don't have to, look, you know, Rollins and Ambrose are tag team champions now. And they are, for now anyway, reunited, right? Two-thirds of the Shield. You don't have to rush this. You can hold off until WrestleMania. The only way you can get Roman Reigns, I think, cheered, let's say in that final ending scene at WrestleMania, having won the championship and slayed the beast and all that. And maybe you just can't. Maybe it's impossible. But to me, there's one way to do it, and the only way to do it is to have Rollins and Ambrose get involved, and at the end, they help him win the championship, and they all come together, all three fists, for the big fist bump in the middle of the ring. That's the only way. And I think that would get a big reaction. That would get people excited. That would get people interested in seeing the Shield reunited. And then you can just go from there. And I think that would help Roman more than it would help, say, Ambrose and Rollins, who are already very popular. In fact, I could see Vince doing it specifically for that very reason, because it would help Roman, right? So let's do it. But that's, look, that's what I would do. The guy's getting the championship, whether you like it or not. At least that would make things kind of interesting. You know, are they then a heel faction? Are they sort of tweeners? Do they just keep acting like they're acting now? You know, I'd say maybe somewhere in the middle. You know, you want to make them kind of, I guess they can never really be rebels the way they kind of were when they first came in. That bloom is long off the rose. But that would, to me, make Reigns a far more interesting character if all of a sudden he reunited with the other two and they started running roughshod on the Raw brand. Let's see here. We have the Lake George Lunatic, Bobby Blanchard. What's up, Bobby? My youngest son was riding in the car with me the other day, and he suddenly asked me, what is the rarest wrestling match? I guess he means stipulation. He said the question caught me off guard, but I immediately thought of the scaffold match, which is something that we will never see in WWE. What do you think is the rarest match? I did not include matches like Ring of Fire, which was so awful they only did it once. Rarest match stipulations. Scaffold would definitely be one of them. I would throw First Blood in there, although we haven't seen that for obvious reasons. We may never see another First Blood match in WWE again, for the obvious reasons, but that's pretty rare. You know, Lion's Den. I think they could bring back the Lion's Den match for Brock Lesnar if Brock had the right opponent. I think that could work. They did at least two of those that I can remember, so unlike the Ring of Fire that they did with Wyatt and Kane that one year at SummerSlam, we have seen more than one Lion's Den match, so they could always resurrect that at some point if they want to. I'm sure they've got that in storage somewhere. I'd throw Empty Arena in there, but I guess we kind of did end up getting a couple of Empty Arena matches at the kickoff show last weekend, so maybe that doesn't count. Dylan from Billings, Montana. Is Floyd Mayweather a WWE Hall of Famer? If so, when do you think he should be inducted? Yeah, I mean, if Drew Carey is in the Hall of Fame, then Mayweather belongs in there. Absolutely. I don't even like Mayweather. And I can tell you that he belongs in the celebrity wing of the Hall of Fame. As far as when, I don't know. It's whenever they can reach a deal. pay the guy to go in. Sean Waters, I was rewatching King of the Ring 2001 and was wondering, had Triple H not gotten injured, what do you think the main event would have been instead of Steve Austin defending in a triple threat against Jericho and Benoit? I have no doubt, and I remember reading, I don't remember where it was, what website it was at the time, but, you know, that the direction they were going to go in possibly was going to be Austin Triple H. You know what? I believe that 100%. I have no doubt in my mind, especially if you think back to what happened at that Judgment Day pay-per-view the night before Triple H tore his quad. Triple H went in there, right? He had a chain match with Kane. He lost the Intercontinental Championship to Kane. How? Because Stone Cold, his partner, got involved and whacked him in the head with a chair by accident. I remember seeing that thinking, okay, maybe now Triple H will come out and cost Austin the match in the main event against The Undertaker, and they'll switch both titles, but they didn't do that. Instead, Triple H, I think, helped Austin. And the next night, they lost their tag team titles to Jericho and Benoit, which I guess was the planned finish anyway. No doubt in my mind they were heading to an Austin-Triple H match. I guess the only question is, were they going to do it at King of the Ring, or were they going to hold off until SummerSlam? But no doubt in my mind whatsoever that was the direction they would have gone in had Triple H not gotten hurt. Probably with Triple H being a babyface, challenging Austin for the championship. And then there's also the question of how would the WCW invasion have changed all of that? Triple H missed that whole invasion. So how would that have affected things? That's what makes me think they would have done the match at King of the Ring, because once everybody invaded and Booker T came out that night at the King of the Ring, remember he put Austin through a table? It would have been like us against them at SummerSlam. I don't think they would have done Austin Triple H at SummerSlam, so they probably would have done it at the King of the Ring. Brian from Virginia, I was wondering why Paul Bearer returned with Kane in 2000. They never explained why he left Undertaker and rejoined Kane. He left 2 months later and they never said why. Do you know why all of this happened like that? I don't know what the idea was. Maybe that's a better question for someone like Bruce Pritchard as far as why they put Paul Bearer back with Kane. It could have just been one of those things where Kane was coming back and they wanted to, you know, change him up a little bit, right? He came back with a new outfit. Looked like a badass when he came back in 2000. And so just to do something different. Paul Bearer had lost a lot of weight, so I think he had gone away for a while. I don't know if that was when he had the gastric bypass or not, but he lost a bunch of weight. And actually, I think that surgery came later on, and then he came back in 04. But I know Undertaker was supposed to come back earlier than he did. That's also one of those what-if questions I sometimes think about when I get emails about it. Because one of my favorite, if not my favorite, return. You know, the big return at like a pay-per-view when somebody comes out and the place goes nuts. My favorite is The Undertaker at Judgment Day in 2000. When he interfered in the Iron Man match between Rock and Triple H. Came out for the very first time as the American Badass. I was not a big fan back then of the American Badass. I missed the old school Dead Man Undertaker. But over the years, I've gained a newfound appreciation for the whole badass, big evil stuff. I like it more now than I did back then. But that night, when he came out on that motorcycle and there were 30 seconds left on the clock, and he got in that ring, the long trench coat, he chokeslammed Shane, he punched Vince in the face, he went after Stephanie, the building was literally shaking, the camera, the hard cam was shaking. That is probably my favorite all-time return. If not my favorite, certainly my top three. I guess I would probably also put the Austin one in there the night that he came back. The old Stone Cold came back before the Invasion pay-per-view and he stunnered everybody. That was actually badass too. God, we don't get moments like that anymore, do we? I was just thinking, like, those two moments are from 2000 and 2001. And, you know, here we are in 2017. And I'm trying to think of, like, a recent return or a big moment like that that even comes close to rivaling the crowd reactions to those two. And off the top of my head, I can't think of any. Maybe if I sat here for a while, I could think of a couple of them. But man, nothing beats the crowds back then. I'm telling you, from like 98 to 01, there was really nothing like a wrestling crowd back then. But anyway, I got off my point here. Point is, Undertaker was supposed to come back in January, not May. He had been out. He had some surgery. He was training for a comeback. I remember, you know, reading reports, Undertaker's on schedule to come back in January. And then in training, he tore his pec. And that kept him out another 3-4 months. And I always thought, like, when the lights went out on that one episode of Raw, and Paul Bearer came out in the red jacket, and out came Kane, and they said, oh, Kane is back, and they made such a big deal. The reality is, Kane had only been off TV for, like, literally, I think, 2 weeks, maybe 3 weeks. He wasn't gone that long. I thought Undertaker was coming out. I thought they were going to reunite Paul Bearer and The Undertaker. So I wonder if that was the original plan. But once Undertaker got hurt and tore his pec and was going to be out a few more months, they just said, you know what? We've got Paul Bearer. Let's just put him back with Kane. So that's what makes me think perhaps that was the original plan, but Taker getting hurt sort of derailed all of that. But it also makes me wonder if Undertaker was just going to come back as the Dead Man. Or was he going to come back as the American Badass in January? We'll never know. Unless Undertaker writes a book. Or if Stone Cold can ever get his ass on the podcast, which he was supposed to do a few years ago and never did. But Undertaker and Vince McMahon are the two people who I think all the stories that those guys must know, and the stories we will probably never know, like, those are the two guys I would want to hear from the most, like in a book or something. And I feel like Undertaker would be a hell of a lot more honest than Vince would be, but I just don't think it's ever going to happen. Nelson from Buffalo, New York, you recently talked about there being nothing left to do for Billy Kay and Peyton Royce in NXT. What do you think about them coming up to Raw and forming an Aussie Shield-like faction with Emma? I think Emma is criminally underused. Now that Sasha Banks is champion, they can feud with her until Bayley comes back. Do you think that could work? Well, look, of course it could work. But you got to have the right people behind it to make it work. Is Vince behind the idea of Emma, leading a faction? Obviously not. Look at what they've done with Emma. Emma, let me tell you, when it comes to Emma, I think Emma was done when she got arrested for the whole shoplifting thing and they fired her and then they unfired her because there was a whole uproar about it. I think at that point, if they had any plans for her, that was it. And then they were going to do the whole Emelina thing. Maybe that was going to be her second chance. And then she crapped the bed on that, right? She came out, they were having her sort of do like a test run or an audition for it before the show, and Vince wasn't happy. She just couldn't pull it off. That was the nail in the coffin. Now, they ended up giving the whole Emelina thing to Lana. I wouldn't say Lana exactly has knocked it out of the park, but the Emelina thing was it. I don't see them doing anything with Emma, and I think there's a very good reason why she's coming out and getting squashed every week in 30 seconds, because they gave up on her. So could the idea work? Yeah, I think it could work. Absolutely. And I think Billy Kay and Peyton Royce, they've done all they can do in NXT. It's time for them to come up to the main roster anyway, and I would keep them together. I wouldn't split them up. But it's never going to happen, because they just keep Emma around to have her. I said earlier, if she's employed by this company in a year, whether they get rid of her or she says, sayonara, I'm out of here, and leaves on her own, a year from now, if she's still working in WWE, I'd be shocked. The Emelina thing was the nail in the coffin. Once she couldn't pull that off, that was it. They're not going to trust her anymore. Rob from Pleasant Prairie, Wisconsin. After his appearance at WrestleMania 17, why didn't Bobby Heenan return to WWE on a more consistent basis? My understanding is that his throat cancer diagnosis came in late 01, early 02. So why nothing before then? Was it bad timing? Given the invasion angle they were doing at the time, did Heenan still have a bad taste in his mouth from WCW? Or was he feeling the effects of his illness before the official diagnosis? I don't know if he was feeling the effects before he was diagnosed or not. I have watched some Bobby Heenan shoot interviews. I know he really enjoyed being invited to do the whole gimmick battle royal thing with Mean Gene at WrestleMania 17 in 01. It was a thrill for me to see him back. I'm a big, big Bobby Heenan. I'm as big a Bobby Heenan fan as you're going to find. So when he came back at WrestleMania that year, that was really cool. And I was hoping he'd stick around and do some stuff. There really wasn't a spot for him on commentary at the time. But how many people over the years have we seen on Raw or at the pay-per-views, they trot out for that one segment with Slaughter and Ricky Steamboat and Hacksaw Jim Duggan and Ric Flair, like, yeah, the legends. And it kills me because Bobby Heenan should have been a part of all that stuff and just couldn't be. And it really, like, depresses me when I think about that. As far as why he didn't come in, let's say, after WrestleMania that year, like the early to mid part of 01. I don't think the invasion had anything to do with it. In one of the interviews I saw Heenan do, he was asked, like, do you want to go back? Would you go back if they asked you? And he was up for it. So it was not something where he was like, I would not do it. I'm not interested in going back or being on TV. The one thing he did say is he did not want to travel. He did not want to travel the way they used to have him traveling. So as far as him being like a consistent part of the show or being an announcer and going on the road, that he didn't want to do. So maybe he let them know that and they said, well, if you don't want to be, you know, maybe they had a role for him and he just said, look, I'm not interested. I want to come back in some way, but not to do that. And they just didn't have a role. I think that's really what it boiled down to. He didn't want to go back out on the road, and they just didn't have a role for him. And it was not a year later that he had the throat cancer. And it just, over the years, it took quite the toll on him. And it's a shame, because he could have had a lot of very comedic moments, I think, on that show over the years. It would have been cool for like the newer generation of people to become familiar with who Bobby Heenan was. And because he couldn't do that, and because WWE never bothered to really educate people about who he was because he wasn't around. So, you know, you have all these younger fans and newer fans who don't even know who Bobby Heenan is. And he did do that segment at WrestleMania 20, you know, the backstage bit with Mean Gene, and he got caught kind of smooching with Mae Young. That was kind of funny. He did do that one segment, and that's the sort of thing I would have envisioned him doing more of in the future, even if it was maybe just an annual WrestleMania thing. But certainly he could have been part of those legend segments that I mentioned a moment ago. But that would have been the kind of the comedic role for him, I think, going forward. And it just really bums me out that, again, like I said, you have all these newer fans and all these younger fans who really have had no exposure to him because he hasn't been around, and they don't know the kind of role he played as a manager, as an announcer. You can go on the network certainly and watch all the old stuff. I know they did a Bobby Heenan DVD many years ago. They didn't really push it too hard, but they did come out with some kind of career retrospective for him. But by no means, I think, with the newer audience, is he looked at or regarded as some sort of great legend in WWE and one of the best of all time, which he absolutely is. And I think he should always be remembered as one of the best of all time as a manager and as a color commentator, because whatever that guy did, and I'll speak for myself here, but I'm sure I'm not the only one, whatever he did, whatever role he played, he knocked it out of the park. I was never all that impressed with what he was doing in WCW, but even he said by that point, you know, after the first couple of years when he saw the writing on the wall and would make suggestions and it would get knocked down, you're just an announcer, you know, you're not here to contribute and give ideas, he sort of gave up. I don't even really pay too much attention to the years in WCW, honestly. I think he's more known in WCW for that one moment where he sort of, people say he gave away the finish of Hogan turning and Bash at the Beach, which he really, if you think about it, he really didn't give anything away. I mean, Bobby Heenan was always a heel who hated Hulk Hogan. So if anybody was going to doubt Hogan's intentions and him coming out, it kind of fit the character, right? It you would expect Bobby Heenan to make a comment like that. So I don't necessarily agree when people say, oh, remember that time he spoiled the outcome? Well, not really. I wouldn't go that far. But I remember his body of work in WWE, and I just wish more people, more newer fans would be able to appreciate it. Dustin from Barberville, Kentucky. Do you know anything about the murder of Dino Bravo, and what do you think could have led to his demise? Also, if he hadn't been murdered, do you think he would have remained in either WWF or WCW? Well, he died probably, what, like a year and a half maybe after he left WWE. So he was out of the wrestling business. So had he not been murdered, I mean, who's to say that at some point he wouldn't have tried to come back, or they could have trotted him out for like cameos and stuff in later years, but I think he was done, so I don't think you would have seen him anymore. I've talked about this actually at length. Back when I used to do the This Week in History stuff, I'm pretty sure it was during one of those segments where I talked about his murder. His murder was tied into he was like dealing in illegal cigarettes, and I think he allegedly crossed the mafia. You know, it had something to do with that, because look at the way he was murdered, right? He was killed. I think he was sitting maybe in a chair watching TV at home, and the guy was assassinated, for God's sakes. He was shot up a whole bunch of times. This was a mob hit through and through, and, you know, that's what happens when you get involved in the illegal cigarette trade or the illegal drug trade or whatever. You know, you kind of You lay down with dogs and you get fleas. And when that happens and you cross the wrong people, bad shit's going to happen. So he got in with the wrong people and he paid the price for it. Pierre from Montreal. I've been thinking about this while watching a John Cena match, how almost everybody is kicked out of his AA. It got me to think about main eventers who had weak finishers. For example, Shane Douglas had a belly-to-belly suplex and Sting had the Scorpion Death Drop. Which main event... What's wrong with the Scorpion Death Drop, dude? Which main eventer do you think had the weakest finisher? Oh, I can answer this easily. The weakest finisher goes to Jinder Mahal. The Colossus is a terrible finish for the WWE champion. That is an awful finish. Look, I'm sure there's others, but I got this question now when Jinder Mahal happens to be champion, and I've talked about how awful that finish is. And so that's the one I thought of first, and so that's the one I'm going to go with. I mean, there have been others, even the AA. Although it depends. Sometimes Cena throws the guy and it's kind of impressive. But it is, at the end of the day, just a fireman's carry slam. I mean, that's really all it is. But the Colossus, I think, is just... it's a terrible finish. Jacob sent me a screenshot of a Facebook post from Marty Jannetty, which he has since deleted. So I can't call it the tweet and delete. It was the Facebook and delete, I guess we'll call it. He wants to know what I think about what Marty posted and if it qualifies for sad tweet. Well, I mean, it wasn't posted on Twitter, so it can't be sad tweet. It'd be more of a Facebook fail than a sad tweet. So this is the story. Marty Jannetty has posted some very weird shit on his Facebook page in the past. He has claimed that he has had multiple offers to do porn, just as an example. This, though, takes the cake. He posted a picture of a woman, a young woman, very pretty, that he apparently thought was his daughter. Yeah, you know where I'm going with this. Can't be too good. I'm just going to read you what he wrote here, since somebody screen capped it. I'm going to read you what he wrote here verbatim. I'm just going to read this, okay? This is what Marty Jannetty wrote on his Facebook. "If you loves me as much as I loves you, you will give your opinion. Just did DNA 2 weeks ago. She's not my daughter. We both held out of sex because you don't do that. But now that we ain't, from a guy's side, she's fucking hot. But she's been daughter. I want to, but can't get past that." Can't get past that. So basically, he wants people's opinion on whether or not it's okay to have sex with a girl that up until now he thought might be his daughter. If you were wondering what Marty Jannetty has been up to, now you know. He's been making the tough decisions. Maybe that could be a plot line for his next porno. Adam from London, England. "I'm a huge fan of British wrestling and progress, and while I'm not watching WWE at all at the moment, I enjoy listening to your show to keep up with what's going on. Hearing you talk about UK guys like Pete Dunne, Tyler Bate, Trent Seven, and Mark Andrews so positively is so cool, as I've been lucky enough to watch them up close regularly this year at shows here in the UK. I do wonder what the end goal is in WWE with these guys. A dedicated UK show on the network could work, but given 205 Live's troubles, a lot of effort would have to be put in to make sure that it isn't lost in the shuffle. The rumors about Progress and ICW being added to the network have been brought up and shot down time again. I don't see it happening." Well, I do think it's going to happen. I don't know what the holdup has been. Some people, I've heard that Vince McMahon is the holdup. It's his call, and he just hasn't given the green light yet. Both promotions have made moves that would lead you to believe that they have gotten ready for the big move to the network. It just hasn't happened yet. I do think that will happen. I'm not so confident anymore that there's going to be a UK-only show. Apparently, it's not dead. It's just delayed. I have a feeling that won't end up happening, but I do think ICW and Progress will end up on the network at some point. So if that's something you're looking forward to, then keep hope alive. Anyway, he says, "Personally, I'd like to see them integrated into the NXT show week to week as regular members of the roster and have feuds for the UK title." He mentions here that you could even do faction warfare and do members like Pete Dunne and Tyler Bate and Trent Seven, who have ruled over Progress as a heel faction. You can have them maybe feud with Adam Cole and Red Dragon and NXT. Anyway, how do you use the UK division going forward is what he wants to know. And as I was saying earlier during the NXT review, I said I was going to come back to this. I am kind of appalled, honestly, that we saw that UK title match earlier at TakeOver Chicago this year between Pete Dunne and Tyler Bate, which I think is still, to me, the WWE match of the year. I'll sit down at the end of the year and we'll see, but I can't think of a better match in this company that I've seen this year so far than that one. And yet we have not seen a single defense of the UK title anywhere on WWE television since then. And even just featuring the guys. I mean, when I saw them in that tag match in Brooklyn last weekend during the NXT tapings before TakeOver, that was the first time we've seen these guys in months. And you say to yourself, how is that possible? When those two guys go out there and put on the kind of match they put on and the talent that they have, how are you not, you know, doing more with them in your own company? I get that you've got these contracts they've signed where they can still go out and wrestle in ICW in Progress and take all these indie bookings, and that's great for them. It's not like they're not working. They're still working now as much as they've worked before. But, you know, as a fan, I want to see them on WWE television. You kind of teased us with these guys, and then they sort of vanished. So I agree with you. They absolutely need to do more with them. They absolutely have to start having some UK title defenses. I would do the same thing. I would integrate them into the NXT brand, and I would start featuring them there. People have talked a lot about, does NXT need a secondary title? I have been of the opinion for a while now, at least the last year, if not longer, that they do. And after Dusty Rhodes passed away, my suggestion was that they do a deal where they institute, you know, something called the Dream Title, and the Dream Title can be that secondary championship in NXT. Instead, they did the Dusty Classic, which was fun. Yeah, that's fine. They still honor Dusty in some way, and they still do the Dusty Classic every year, and that's cool. I still think they absolutely need a secondary title on that brand. I wouldn't go hog wild and add like three different belts. You know, one more I think would be fine. And I'm almost thinking now, you know what? You don't need to create a new championship. You've got one. The UK title. The UK title can be the de facto sort of secondary almost makes it look, you know, inferior, but that can be the other championship that gets defended in NXT. You don't need to create anything new. The UK title is it. So yeah, that's what I would do. I mean, when you start getting into these ideas, I would do faction warfare against them, against Adam Cole and Red Dragon. I mean, now you're fantasy booking. You can do that. I don't really care what the creative is. I trust NXT a lot more than I do the main roster, so I'm sure whatever they come up with for these guys would be good. But get them on TV and let that UK title be the secondary belt that some people think that show should already have. We'll do one more here. Adam from Coventry, England, buy or sell on the better TLC match, TLC from WrestleMania 16 with Edge and Christian, the Hardys and the Dudleys, or TLC 2 from WrestleMania 17 with the same three teams. The match at WrestleMania 16 was not a TLC match. First TLC match was at SummerSlam that year. I think they just called the WrestleMania match like a triangle ladder match or whatever. So before people write in and say that, I just wanted to make that clear. But if I'm comparing the two matches, I got TLC 2 is my favorite of all the TLC matches. I think it's the best one, and it's my favorite one. So I'm absolutely going to buy on that one here, which is not to say WrestleMania 16 was a bad match, but this one was better. So I'm buying on WrestleMania 17, and I'm selling on WrestleMania 16. Plus, the one at 17 had that classic iconic moment with Jeff Hardy spearing Edge from the very top all the way down to the ring. That's going to live on in highlight reels until the day those guys die. When those guys went, well, I guess Edge is already in, but when Jeff Hardy goes into the Hall of Fame one day, believe me, that'll be in his video package. So we'll wrap up the mailbag there. Keep sending in your questions, thesolemonster@gmail.com. I will be back, brand new podcast, as always, Labor Day weekend. It is Labor Day, but the work for me never ends, so we'll be back with episode 511 next Sunday. We've got the first round of the Mae Young Classic starting this week. Dropping, I should say, on the network tomorrow. I'm going to try to watch all of it, or at least as much of it as I can, in this next week, if I could fit it all in. And I will have a review of whatever I've watched on the podcast next week. So they're doing this a little bit differently. You know, and Triple H talked about this on the conference call he did before TakeOver, where the Cruiserweight thing was spread out over the course of 10 weeks. And he said that as the Cruiserweight tournament went on, the viewership got lower and lower. So what they decided to do this time was they're just going to do like the Netflix thing, and they're going to do the whole, they'll drop the whole first round at once, and people can binge watch, and they're going to monitor. They're going to see how many people watch it, you know, are there more people watching it, are there less people watching it? So point is, I know not all of you are necessarily going to watch it, so just be aware of that. I am going to review stuff that can technically be considered spoilerish. I'll warn everybody in advance. You guys know me. I'll warn you if I'm going to, you know, talk about stuff that you don't want to hear about. So we'll get into all that next weekend. I'm sure there'll be a ton of other stories that break. It seems that every week there's a ton of stories that break. There's never any rest for the weary here. Again, check out my SummerSlam review, 100,000 strong. Thank you so much for that. And check out all my interviews from the 2K18 launch party. Kurt Angle, Jinder Mahal, Bobby Roode, all that good stuff. It's all up on the YouTube channel. I got some other stuff hitting YouTube very soon, so please subscribe to me there. Even if YouTube doesn't pay me, I'll still do it anyway because I like doing it. And we'll see you back here for more Sound Off next weekend, as always. So until then, be well, stay safe, have yourselves a great week. Enjoy the end of August. Fall is almost here. Where'd the summer go, man? I don't know. But I'll be back next weekend. Take care, guys.
The good, the bad, and the ugly. The Salamonster sounds off.
Mundo goes to leave, and Taya says, "Wait, aren't you going to put any pants on?" He just goes, "No time for pants," and he walks off. That also happens to be Randy Orton's philosophy in life. My philosophy, too. You see, you don't know if I'm wearing pants right now or not, do you? You can't see. I could be wearing nothing right now for all you know. No time for pants.
Salamonster sounds off. Since 2007, the Salamonster sounds off. Available at thesalamonster.com, Stitcher Radio, TuneIn Radio, iTunes, and more.
Solo Monsters sound off.